Disclaimer: this episode of Dead Souls may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
It's just after 4 a.m. on the 5th of September, 1972. The Olympic Village in Munich is quiet. The world's greatest athletes are asleep, dreaming of winning medals, setting world records, and the chance to make history and make their countries proud. The 1972 Olympic Games were meant to represent a new Germany, a peaceful, welcoming Germany, far removed from the horrors of the Second World War. A lifetime away from the previous, heavily militarized German Olympic Games in 1936 under Adolf Hitler's Nazi regime, security at the 1972 Munich Olympic Games was deliberately relaxed. In fact, there was no security, just a group of what was called, quote-unquote, friendly, unarmed guards. The atmosphere was open, friendly, optimistic, happy and cheerful. But that image would quickly shatter. You see, when 8 heavily armed men scaled a chain-link fence carrying duffel bags filled with assault rifles and grenades, their target wasn't the stadium or the Olympic Games themselves. It wasn't the crowds. It was a group of Israeli athletes and coaches. By the time the sun rose over Munich, the 1972 Olympic Games had become the stage for one of the most shocking acts of terrorism the modern world has ever witnessed. In tonight's episode, we are tracing the events of the 21 harrowing hours, from the planning of the attack and the hostage crisis that unfolded before a global television audience, to the disastrous rescue attempt at Fürstenfeldbruck Air Base, and the lasting impact the massacre had on Israel, the wider world, and the Olympic Games themselves. This is the story of how a celebration of peace became a tragedy that changed the world forever.
Guten Morgen und guten Appetit. A morning like any other in Munich. A city where tradition and modernity exist happily side by side. This summer, our beautiful city plays host to the 20th Olympic Games. There, in the center of the future Olympic site, is the Olympic Tower. Next to it, the Olympic Arena. For many visitors, Munich is a kind of German paradise. We're sure that you'll agree.
Are you an Olympics person? I'm not much of a sports person at all. But every Olympics, I end up catching a few events. Maybe the opening ceremony too. Because watching Welsh athletes, for me, the men and the women, competing on the global stage, fills me with moments of anticipation, a nervousness or anxiety for my home nation to do well in the eyes of the world. The Olympics brings out the patriotism in us all. There's nothing like hearing your country's national anthem played in over those huge speakers. The Olympics always brings out the best in nations, a peaceful event that promotes healthy competition and sportsmanship, that's devoid of politics, where men and women from all nations can put their differences aside for a few short weeks to come together over a series of games. But there was one games that fell into disaster, where politics was too divisive at the time to allow everyone to forget. Now, 50 years later, those specific games are still remembered as some of the most tragic games. A games remembered for murder and terror over sportsmanship and cooperation. In 1972, the Olympic Games were held in Munich, Germany. The first time the Games had been held in Germany since 1936. Jews hadn't been allowed to participate back then. A decade later, a third of the world's Jews were gone, murdered by the Nazis. But now it was 1972. Now the Jewish people had their own state. Now they had their own Olympic team. The world was healing. And for Israel, the Olympics were a really big deal that year. Some of those Olympians were Holocaust survivors themselves. They were living a bittersweet victory. Jewish athletes were returning to the very place that had tried to erase them. The eight men who interrupted those games were all well aware of that bittersweetness. They knew exactly why it mattered for Israel to show up at the Munich Olympics in 1972, and they knew exactly what they were doing when they kidnapped, tortured, and murdered 11 Israeli athletes and coaches. Much of it was broadcast on live television for the world to voyeuristically watch. They had their own message that they wanted to send to the world. I am producing this episode because what happened at the Olympics in 1972 is just as relevant today as it was back then. Nothing has seemingly changed, and history certainly does, it seems, repeat itself. I never imagined that the 1972 Olympics would feel so relevant in 2026. But here we are. It's the 1970s. For those of you who weren't alive back then, it must have been a memorable decade. Discos, the counterculture revolution, and Saturday Night Fever. My parents will tell you that that's when music was good and movies were proper movies. But the 1970s saw another kind of fever, the epidemic of terrorism. Today, many of us accept terrorism as part of current events, something to be expected. It's been around for years, decades. But prior to the 1970s, it wasn't really like this. Events across the world, including the Troubles in Northern Ireland and the Argentinian Dirty War, contributed to the 70s being termed as the Golden Age of Terrorism. Throughout that decade, Palestinian terrorism reached new levels of intensity and frequency too. At the infamous 1936 Olympic Games held in Nazi Germany, just 36 years earlier, Hitler used the event as a propaganda machine for the superiority of the Aryan race. They actually described it and promoted it that way. In 1972, Olympics were supposed to be Germany's chance to show the international community in their own country just how much they had changed. It's crazy just how much the world actually had changed between 1945 and 1972. How much has the world changed between the year 2000 and now? Well, that's roughly the same gap. But the Munich Olympics in 1972 was supposed to showcase the new face of Germany. Germany wanted to be seen as a peace-loving, welcoming, and friendly country. Germany actually named the upcoming events the not-so-subtle, quote, Olympics of Peace and Joy, or Der Spiele des Friedens und der Freude. They wanted to show Germany as embracing the whole world. But you know that feeling when someone is trying way too hard and overcompensating a little bit too much? Well, yeah, it was kind of like that. There was not a single uniformed police officer or soldier in or around the Olympic Games, for example. So any and all security was, well, zero. The attendance of the Israeli team at this event, only 27 years after the end of the Holocaust, cannot be overstated enough. The Israeli athletes, many of whom lost relatives in the Holocaust, waved the Israeli flag over German soil, only 6 miles from the Dachau concentration camp. Israel was making a strong statement of both Jewish resilience and Israel's readiness to accept a different Germany. 6 German postmen are walking through the Munich Olympic Village at 4:10 a.m. on the morning of the 5th of September 1972. They're heading towards the village's temporary post office. they notice some commotion near Gate 25A. A group of men wearing tracksuits are helping each other scale the 6-foot fence which surrounded the athletes' village complex. This was not an unusual sight. Many Olympic athletes sneaked out of the village after dark to enjoy a night out on the town. To avoid getting into trouble with event officials or their coaches, some Olympians would climb over the low fence once they returned from their night out drinking at one of Munich's many beer halls. But the postmen are suspicious of this group of fence jumpers who are carrying duffel bags and seemingly moving with purpose. So they decide to report the sighting to local officials. No action, however, will be taken. The motto of the Olympic security team is, quote, the cheerful group. They are more like tour guides or customer service representatives. You see, a week earlier, the best athletes in the world gathered in Munich to celebrate the 20th Olympiad. West Germany bid on the 1972 Olympics to show how the country has evolved into a humane and democratic state after rising from the ashes of the genocidal Third Reich. 7,134 athletes from 121 countries will partake in 195 sporting events between the 26th of August and the 11th of September. All while millions watch on television the world over. Israel has sent its largest delegation ever as a state, with 14 athletes competing. Henry Hershkovitz is a sports shooter who carries the Israeli flag for the opening ceremony. He described the emotional moment to reporters afterwards, saying, quote,
I felt awesome pride that Jews could raise their flag on German soil. This is proof that the Nazis weren't able to crush the Jewish spirit, the Israeli spirit.
Shmuel Lalkin is the head of the Israeli Olympic delegation, and he later said, quote,
the atmosphere was to let everybody feel that Germany has changed from the time of 1936.
A loud and sustained cheer greets the Israelis as the opening ceremony, serving as a powerful symbol of reconciliation, opens to millions across the world. However, some Israelis are uneasy about competing in Germany. Their anxiousness is deep in the pit of their stomach. They are not sure they can ever let it go. Tuvia Sokolsky is a weightlifting trainer and a Holocaust survivor. He later said, quote,
for me, Germans in Munich mean the extermination of 6 million Jews. This, for me, included my father and his family. I cannot simply let this go.
On the 28th of November 1971, the Jordanian Prime Minister Wasfi Tal was assassinated by members of an obscure organization named Black September. Black September were a Palestinian militant group with ties to the Fatah faction of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, and its leader Yasser Arafat. The group was formed in response to the Kingdom of Jordan's crackdown on Fatah and the other pro-Palestinian militant organizations. Very little is known about Black September, thanks in part to its decentralized structure. Black September members operate in small cells of no more than a dozen men and only receive instructions from third-party intermediaries working with the PLO. This organizational structure assures secrecy and offers deniable plausibility to the PLO leadership. The assassination of Prime Minister Tal is the first time Black September claimed responsibility for an attack, and its activity ramps up over the course of 1971 and 72. On the 8th of May 1972, Black September operatives hijacked Sabena Flight 571 en route from Brussels to Tel Aviv, and they demanded the release of Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. The following day, the aircraft was stormed by Israeli special forces, with future prime ministers Ehud Barak and Benjamin Netanyahu amongst them. All but one hostage is saved, but the failure of the hijacking only hardens the resolve of the Black September leadership. In fact, the PLO sends two letters to the Olympic Committee at the beginning of 1972. The letters ask that Palestinian athletes be allowed to compete in the Munich Olympic Games. This letter was ignored. At a meeting in Rome between Black September commanders Abu Daoud and Abu Iyad, Iyad suggests that the next target should be the Olympics, specifically in response to the snub. Iyad recruits an 8-person commando team led by Lutif Afif, codenamed Issa, and his deputy Youssef Nazal, codenamed Tony. The pair travel to Munich and take temporary jobs in the Olympic Village to enable them to scout the area. The rest of the conspirators arrive in Munich in pairs and stash smuggled assault rifles, grenades and ammunition in lockers at the Munich train station. By the 4th of September, all Black September operatives are in place and the team retrieves their weapons from the train station before setting out for the Olympic Village. As well as leader Issa and his deputy Tony, the remainder of the militants consist of Adnan Al-Gashi, codenamed Dinawi, and his cousin Jamal Al-Gashi, codenamed Samir, Afif Ahmed Hamid, codenamed Paolo, Khalid Jawad, codenamed Salah, Ahmed Sheikh Tha, codenamed Abu Hala, and Mohammed Safadi, codenamed Badran. At 4:30 a.m, Issa and the other militants assemble at the far end of 31 Connolly Straße, a two-story apartment building where the Israeli delegation is staying in apartments 1 to 5. They had been helped over the fence into the Olympic Village by a group of Canadian athletes who were sneaking back into the village after a night out themselves. They had assumed the group were fellow athletes doing the same as them. Issa knows from his reconnaissance that the door to the Connolly Straße building is never locked, and he leads 6 militants into the communal foyer in apartment 1. All this while Jamal Al-Gashi stays behind to guard the entrance. The militants unzip their duffel bags and pull out AK-47s before snapping magazines into place. The Black September operatives have been specifically instructed not to kill any of the Israelis except in the instance of self-defense, if it comes to it. Issa slowly inserts a copy of the apartment door key into the lock, but the door does not open. He struggles with the key for a while before realizing that the lock is inserted upside down. Several Israeli coaches and referees are sleeping in apartment 1 when the militants arrive. One of them is 40-year-old referee Joseph Gutfreund, who is awoken by scratching sounds. He walks into the common area to investigate the noises. When Issa finally manages to unlock the door, Gutfreund comes face to face with a group of armed men pointing AK-47s at him. Gutenfreud quickly shouts, quote,
"Take cover, boys."
He then rushes the door, throwing the full weight of his 6'3", 290-pound frame against it while the militants try pushing back. Gutenfreud's roommate was weightlifting trainer and Holocaust survivor Tuvia Solosky, who runs into the communal area. Solosky later said, quote,
"Through the half-open door, I saw a man with a black-painted face holding a weapon. At that moment, I knew I had to escape."
He runs back into his bedroom and tries to open the window while shouting, quote,
"Guys, run to the rest of the Israelis."
Gutfreund manages to bar the door for 10 seconds before the militants use their assault rifles as crowbars to force the entrance open. He is overpowered and taken hostage, while the Black September operatives spread out into the rest of the Israeli rooms. Solosky is still struggling to open the window when the militants break in. He desperately punches through the thick double glass and throws himself out of the window just as the Black September operatives enter his room. Bleeding profusely from his head, hands and legs, he gets off the ground and runs for help. The militants fire their AK-47s, but Solosky manages to evade them and finds cover behind the corner of a building. Back in the apartment, Issa bursts into the bedroom of wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg. Weinberg grabs a fruit knife and slashes at the militant leader's face, but Issa narrowly avoids the blade. Weinberg rushes Issa and knocks him down while grabbing at his rifle. A militant behind Issa aims and fires a single round, which tears through the wrestling coach's cheek, sending Weinberg spinning to the ground, but not killing him. He is then taken hostage along with the six other Israelis in apartment 1, bleeding heavily from his face. Tuvia Solosky is the only man to escape. In apartment 5, head of the delegation, Shmuel Lalkin, is awoken by gunfire and goes to his window to investigate. The night is now deathly silent, leading Lalkin to believe a sports shooter has accidentally discharged a round. Back in apartment 1, Issa's deputy, Youssef Nazal, Tony, demands that a wounded Weinberg leads the militants to round up the athletes. They march him outside with a gun at his back towards apartment 2, where the fencing team and sports shooters are staying. However, Weinberg lies and tells the terrorists that the inhabitants are not Israeli, and instead directs them to apartment 3. You see, six weightlifters and wrestlers are sleeping in apartment 3, and it's likely that Weinberg believed that these burly athletes would have a better chance of overpowering their attackers. The militants gather at the door of apartment 3, and they cock their assault rifles and creep inside the two-story duplex. Wrestler Gad Sabari is on the second floor and had been awakened by gunshots, but believed he was dreaming. He is trying to get some more sleep, but upon hearing voices outside his bedroom door, he climbs out of bed and opens it. He finds a terrorist is pointing a gun at his friends Mark Slavin and Elza Halvin, who have already been taken hostage. The militant turns his attention to Sabari and his roommate David Berger. The four men are pushed down the stairs at gunpoint to join weightlifters Youssef Rabano and Ziv Friedman, along with Moshe Weinberg. One of the militants starts tearing apart cabinets and overturning beds to find other Israelis, while Youssef Nazal demands to know where the rest of the delegation is. None of the Israelis answer, and the athletes are pushed into a line with their hands above their heads. This includes Romano, who is on crutches after tearing a ligament during competition. A defiant David Berger quickly says in Hebrew, quote, Bo nista al elahem, in linu me lapsid, which means let's pounce on them. We have nothing to lose. Hearing this, a militant jams a rifle barrel into Berger's back and pushes the Israelis out into the corridor. Tony leaves apartment 3 and begins herding the Israelis back to apartment 1, where the rest of the hostages are under strict guard. Tabari is the first athlete in line and believes he and his friends are about to be executed. Upon reaching the door of apartment 1, he makes a spontaneous decision to escape. The militant guarding the door motions for Sabari to enter the room, but the 106-pound flyweight wrestler instead slaps the barrel of his AK-47 aside and runs down the stairs leading to the underground car park. Two Black September operatives chase after Sabari, leaving two guarding the five Israelis still standing outside the door. Moshe Weinberg takes advantage of the chaos and attacks one of the militants, landing a punch so hard that several of the militants' teeth go flying. One of the terrorists chasing Sabari turns around and fires a burst of bullets from his AK-47, killing Weinberg. The other militant fires at Sabari, but the wrestler escapes. The rest of the hostages are quickly shoved into apartment 1. Shmuel Lalkin is now wide awake and rushes to the window to see Weinberg's lifeless body laying in a pool of blood on the pavement. He races to the first floor living room and calls an outside line to the Sheraton Hotel, where the Israeli journalists and Olympic officials are all staying. He shouts down the phone, quote,
"Call Israel. Arab militants have taken part of our delegation hostage."
In apartment 2, race walker Shaul Ladani leaps from the second floor balcony and runs to the building where the United States Olympic team are staying, pleading with them for help. A survivor of the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, Ladani wakes up US track coach Bill Bowerman, who shelters him in his room. Only 10 minutes have passed since the Black September operatives first stormed Apartment 1, where hostages are now being kept in a second-floor bedroom. The Israelis are now seen to be all tied together.
This is an ITN newsflash from the Olympic Village in Munich, where early this morning, armed Palestinian guerrillas raided the sleeping quarters of the Israeli team.
Yusuf Romano now makes his own move. He tosses his crutches aside and tackles one of the militants, knocking his AK-47 from his hands. Romano grabs the assault rifle, but is shot by one of the hostage takers before he can fire back. Romano is mortally wounded. He gradually bleeds out, left to die on the floor in front of his friends. In a deliberate show of disrespect, as Romano is dying, the terrorists castrate and mutilate him as his friends look on. No matter which side of the aisle you sit on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, hearing that the Palestinians mutilated Yusuf Romano is a horrific concept, something that burns itself into your mind. Nothing about that is freedom fighting. It's pure barbarism. Two of the Israelis who initially fought the terrorists have now been murdered. The remaining 9 athletes are taken hostage. The terrorists demanded that Israel release 328 prisoners in exchange for the hostages. If not, the hostages would be executed. Responding to reports of gunfire, the security shift manager in the Olympic Village sends an unarmed guard to investigate at 4:50 a.m. The guard approaches apartment 1 and sees Weinberg's body and a militant near the front door. The guard demands an explanation from the militant, only for the armed man to ignore him and then disappear into the building. The guard calls for backup on his radio, as the gravity of the situation is now becoming apparent.
The man in the room, Yusuf Romano, is 31 years old, an Israeli weightlifter in the middleweight class. David Berger, 26 years old, he's in the light heavyweight class. Ziev Friedman, another 26-year-old weightlifter in the bantamweight class. These strong men sitting helpless there at the point of submachine guns. Eliezer Halfin, 24 years old, a freestyle wrestler, is in that room. Mark Slavin is 18 years old, a Greco-Roman wrestler. The others are officials, Joseph Gottfreund, Yaakov Springer, Andre Spitzer, Kehat Shur, and Amit Zur Shapiro.
Munich Chief of Police Manfred Schreiber receives a call from the Olympic Village at 5 a.m. and immediately orders the complex sealed off. He telephones the Bavarian Minister of the Interior, Bruno Meck, who passes on the news to Federal Interior Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher. An unarmed Munich police officer approaches the apartment building at 31 Connolly-Strasse at 5:10 a.m. He is faced with a Black September militant on the second floor. The militant tosses 2 pieces of paper down onto the pavement in front of him. The paper contains Black September's ultimatum and demands. Moshe Weinberg's body is recovered at 5:30 a.m. Around the same time, German Chancellor Willy Brandt and Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir are informed of the situation. Dozens of military trucks and police vehicles descend upon the Olympic Village while reporters are alerted to the story. Despite this flurry of activity, the West German government is completely unprepared for the hostage situation in the Olympic Village. You see, Germany at this time does not have a counter-terrorist unit. There are no armed guards at the Olympic site, and because of complex German laws following the Second World War, namely the post-Third Reich Constitution, the federal government are prohibited from moving soldiers into the area without the permission of the Bavarian government. Prior to the Games, the West German Olympic Organizing Committee had been desperate to avoid any imagery that would be reminiscent of the Nazis, even if this was at the expense of public safety and common sense. Security at the 1972 Games is extremely lax, even by the standards of the time. Fun fact, the security personnel have only been prepared to deal with ticket fraud and public drunkenness. The chain of command is also unclear to most, with some officials believing that the Bavarian government has sole authority in this situation, while others look to the federal government of Germany. West German police officers arriving at the scene attempt to contact the militants, but to no avail. At 8:10 a.m., a confident and somewhat fiery 42-year-old spokesman named Annalisa Grace volunteers to talk with the Black September operatives. She approaches the door of 31 Connolly Strasse and is greeted in a surprisingly friendly manner by Issa himself. Grace attempts an aggressive approach, initially shouting at Issa, saying, quote,
"What the hell kind of bullshit is this?"
Issa, calmly and with a wry smile, responds with, quote,
"This has nothing to do with you or with Germany."
To which Annalisa Grace says,
"We can do nothing about freeing all those political prisoners you want from Israel. Why not give us conditions that are possible for us to meet?"
She has a point. But Issa, still smiling, simply responds with, quote,
"Free all those prisoners. That is all you have to do. If not, all the hostages will die."
The Black September ultimatum demands the release of imprisoned Arabs and non-Arabs by 9 a.m. the following morning, or else the militants will start executing hostages, one every hour. The list includes Andreas Bader and Ulrich Meinhof, two members of the German Red Army faction, which is a Marxist militant organization operating in West Germany, a decidedly pointed inclusion to the list. The Israeli government categorically refuses to negotiate with Black September, its ambassador relaying Prime Minister Golda Meir's guidelines to West German leadership, namely, 1. Israel will not negotiate with terrorists. 2. Israel will understand if the militants are promised freedom, as long as they free the hostages first. And 3. Israel holds West Germany responsible for the crisis and expects them to do whatever necessary to save the Israeli hostages. With the 9 a.m. deadline being impossible to meet, it's decided to send a small delegation to negotiate directly with the militants. Police Chief Schreiber, Mayor of the Olympic Village, Volta Troger, and an Egyptian member of the International Olympic Committee, Ahmed Damar Danish Touni, approach the building and meet with Issa at the front door. The conversation is tense, with two militants on the second floor pointing their AK-47s at the three men below. Touni tells Issa that both the Israeli and West German governments need time to locate and free the prisoners requested. Issa agrees to extend the deadline until noon. At this time, Schreiber sizes up the militant and considers grabbing him as a hostage. But the suspicious Issa notices this and warns the Munich police chief, quote,
"If you lay a hand on me, I will blow us both up, my friend."
Issa is calm and in control. The small delegation leaves without a resolution to the crisis. But negotiations continue throughout the morning and into the afternoon. The men attempting to free the hostages are improvising their response in real time, as there is no hostage negotiation team in the whole of Germany. In the federal capital of Bonn, Chancellor Willy Brandt is desperate to avoid spilling Israeli blood on German soil and authorizes Schreiber to offer the terrorists an unlimited ransom. The West Germans set up a telephone link with the apartment, and several officials take turns speaking directly to the militants. Their conversations with Issa are polite but fruitless. When Schreiber informs Issa of the unlimited ransom, the militant leader responds simply, quote,
"This is not about money. Talk of money is demeaning to me."
Peter Jennings is inside the village and is observing this with the naked eye. Peter?
Jim, I am almost directly over the Israeli building. It'll be a famous number before long. It's building 31. It's on Connolly Strasse. It does appear to be confirmed, though anything confirmed today is difficult, that these guerrillas are from one of the very extreme left-wing groups, a group called Black September. Continuous delegations go forward, people here waiting, but unquestionably the mood becoming more tense.
They had set a deadline of noon, which is just an hour and 15 minutes away, saying that they were going to kill all of their hostages at that time.
West German Interior Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher offers himself as a hostage, telling Issa, "You know our history. You know what the Third Reich did to the Jews. You need to understand that this can't happen in Germany again. And for this reason, I beg you to do this exchange and take me instead." But he is again turned down by Issa. Despite these setbacks, Black September agrees to extend the deadline to noon, then 1 p.m., then to 3 p.m., and to 5 p.m. After learning of the attack, Avery Brundage, president of the Olympic Committee, controversially declared that the games must go on. In typical German precision, the first athletic event of the day occurred at exactly 8:15 a.m., as two Israelis lay dead and nine Israelis were held hostage. Brundage spent his day dismissing questions and suggestions that the games should be postponed. Jim Murray of the LA Times was astonished by this, writing, quote,
"It's almost like having a dance at Dachau. As the other athletes were sunbathing and playing ping pong, an international nightmare lasting more than 20 hours was happening just a few yards away."
Indeed, while West German officials continue to scramble for a response from the Israeli government regarding meeting the terrorist demands, Chancellor Brandt appeals to Golda Meir to compromise. But the Israeli leader is resolute in her decision, telling a reporter, quote,
"If we should give in, then no Israeli anywhere in the world can feel that his life is safe. It's blackmail of the worst kind."
It soon becomes apparent to West German officials that a peaceful conclusion is unlikely. And Schreiber's deputy police chief, George Wolf, begins preparing a rescue attempt while negotiations drag on. A rescue attempt with a crew who have zero experience in this area of conflict. After mounting pressure on the IOC throughout the day, Avery Brundage finally postpones the games at around 5 p.m. 12 hours after the first hostage was murdered. Whilst the postponement takes effect, behind the scenes, Brundage is pushing the West German authorities to arrange for the hostages and the terrorists to be moved off-site so that the Olympic Games can resume as soon as possible.
On a lovely late summer afternoon, the tense vigil continues. In just a half an hour, the deadline will have expired.
Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, the Israeli government is increasingly pessimistic that the hostages will be saved. Prime Minister Meir orders that the Seirat Matkal Israeli Special Forces unit to prepare to fly to Munich. But the West Germans immediately reject the offer of help, citing constitutional concerns about letting foreign forces operate on German territory. The Seirat Matkal is an elite special force reconnaissance unit of the Israeli Defense Forces, which was founded in 1957 and modelled on the elite British Special Air Service, or SAS. Until the 1980s, the Seirat Matkal were denied to even exist, so any activity in Munich in 1972 would have been completely clandestine to maintain their anonymity. After Germany's refusal to allow the Seirat Matkal to assist, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan dispatches Mossad heads Zvi Zamir and Security Services agent Victor Cohen to Munich to coordinate a rescue operation with the West German government. Zamir was a man of very little patience. Around 50,000 people had filed out of the Olympic Stadium and gathered on the grassy hill overlooking the apartments, along with live television crews. Viewers were horrified to see that once again, Jewish blood was being spilled on German soil. There was a widespread feeling of helplessness. At 4:35 p.m., a German delegation once again approached Issa to beg for another extension to the deadline. Instead, an irritated Issa is tired of the non-stop excuses and wants to put an end to the situation. he demands transport to Cairo in Egypt, where he could conduct negotiations from a nation friendly to the Fatah group. For clarity, in 1958, Yasser Arafat and his friends founded Al-Fatah, which advocated armed struggle against Israel. In 1964, they established the PLO, or Palestinian Liberation Organization, with the goal, according to Arafat, of destroying Israel. There is evidence that the group that led to the massacre emerged from Arafat's Al-Fatah as a splinter cell group called Black September. Although Arafat denied giving approval for the massacre, the United States Department of Defense claims to have found connections between the two groups, and even one of those involved with the plot, Abu Daoud, claims that Arafat approved the plan himself. But back to the hostage situation. After a quick deliberation, the Germans agreed to the Cairo request, but only if they are allowed to speak to the hostages first. Two of the Israelis, Andre Spitzer and Kahat Shor, speak to the Germans from the balcony before they are forcibly pulled back inside. Mayor Troger and Interior Secretary Genscher insist that they must check on the condition of all of the hostages. Isser agrees. The two men enter Apartment 1 and briefly meet with the hostages. Genscher later said, quote, "The image of the room will stay with me for as long as I live. I will never forget those faces, full of fear and yet full of hope." Upon leaving, both of the German politicians know that the crisis will end in bloodshed. The West German government has no intention of letting Black September militants leave the country with the Israeli hostages. A hastily improvised rescue plan is devised, where 13 West German police officers will storm the apartment from the roof via the ventilation shafts. Codename Operation Sunshine, the officers involved have no training in counter-terrorism activities, and although they will be supplied with arms for the operation, none of them have ever fired a weapon before. German police scale the building and prepared to attack the terrorists.
Now, there's been one report attributed to Will Brimsley of the Associated Press, who said that a police lieutenant told him that at 5 o'clock, about 29 minutes from now, Munich time, a volunteer squad of policemen dressed as athletes would storm the Israeli Olympic team headquarters and would come in shooting. These are the volunteer squad of West German border guards. Because of very complicated laws, the German army would not be allowed to participate. And there you see an athlete holding a canvas bag in which is obviously a machine gun.
Shortly after 6 p.m., the officers are in position on the roof and begin to creep towards the apartment balcony. They're less than 2 meters away from the terrorists, and moments before they are out to strike, they stand down. The Munich police had failed to cut power to the apartment, which had a live TV in every room, and the militants watching the operation unfold in real time. The police team had realized that their actions were being broadcast on live television to a worldwide audience. The terrorists are preparing for the strike against them. Had the police team struck, it would have been a total bloodbath. An angry Issa opens the front door at 6:10 p.m. and shouts that two hostages would be killed immediately if the officers on the roof do not withdraw. The mission is an absolute disaster. Police Chief Schreiber calls off the farcical rescue attempt. Time is running short, and a new plan is needed. After furious deliberation, it is decided that the hostages and militants will now be flown by helicopter to Fürstenfeldbruck Airfield, a remote Luftwaffe base around 12 miles west of Munich. There, the West German police will launch another rescue operation. Another round of negotiations at 6:35 p.m. extends the deadline to 9 p.m. in order for an aircraft to be procured, but the militant leader is convinced his men are walking into a trap. But with the crisis entering its 12th hour, Issa agrees with the West German proposal to fly his men out of the country. Meanwhile, Zvi Zamir and Victor Cohen have landed in Munich and offered their expertise to West German officials. But Zamir later commented that the Bavarian officials were extremely hostile towards him and his team throughout. In fact, initially, Zamir said, the West German team wouldn't even talk to them at all. At 7:20 p.m., two Bell UH-1D Huey helicopters land behind the Olympic Village administration building. These are German military helicopters, and they are preparing to take the hostages and their captors to Fürstenfeldbruck airfield. Another last-second plan is hatched to rescue the hostages before they even leave the Olympic Village by ambushing the militants as they walk to the helicopters through the Olympic Village's underground parking garage. Issa, sharp as a tack, again suspects that there may be an attempt on the militants by German authorities, so he insists on walking the route first to check the area out. The militants are ordered to kill the hostages if he does not return in 6 minutes. Issa quickly establishes that the underground parking garage would be a shooting gallery and a bottleneck for the militants. As Issa is completing his walk, armed German police officers are crawling and ducking down to hide from him behind cars and behind pillars in a comedic scene that reeks of unprofessionalism. After his walk, Issa returns and demands that a bus to take the militants and their hostages to the helicopters is provided. The German negotiators, once again, agree without hesitation. But it is another 2 hours before a large bus parks in front of 31 Kornelistrasse. But at 10 p.m, the Black September operatives push the blindfolded Israelis onto the bus in groups of 3 men per militant. All 17 men board the bus in 7 minutes, whereby it sets out for the helicopters, just a 3-minute journey through the underground parking garage towards the administration building across the Olympic Village. West German police are finally able to enter apartment 1 and retrieve Joseph Romano's body.
This is Peter Jennings in the Olympic Village. The Olympic Village is built on various levels, and underneath building 31 and underneath, in fact, all of the buildings here, there is a network of roads. Those alleyways now have been used to bring in a fairly massive security force, including armored cars. And just a short while ago, Howard Cosell noticed that there was considerable activity there.
Over the recent 25 to 30 minutes, there was a flurry of activity. Cars were speeding off, and we now have a corridor or avenue of departure available to the Arabs should a deal have been made and should they be coming out, as now seems likely. So there is a quiet now and an expectancy.
Dead Souls is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Jamie Black, with music by Mark Butler and COAG. Dead Souls is not part of any network or corporation and is entirely independent. Therefore, our views are completely free from any bias or censorship. For more information about our show, follow us on Twitter at Dead Soulscast and Instagram at dead_souls_podcast. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/deadsouls. For $2 a month, you will get access to exclusive ad-free episodes only for Patreon supporters and exclusive access to written articles, blogs, and research. You may have noticed that sometimes our podcast doesn't appear on your YouTube feed, and very often our podcasts get age-restricted or removed altogether. This isn't by accident. We cover topics that are not always algorithm-friendly, and the big corporations don't love it when we talk about certain topics or have certain conversations, especially the kind that challenge mainstream narratives. This is another reason we have created our Patreon. It is a space where we can post full, unfiltered, and uncensored topics that the big platforms and mainstream media don't always like. Proceeds from our Patreon go directly to supporting us, our show, our research, and keeping the lights on here at Dead Souls HQ. Go check it out. patreon.com/deadsouls. That's it for tonight. Part 2 will be out in a few days. Good night, everyone.